Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
20 years ago today, Nelson Mandela walked out of prison a free man after nearly three decades in captivity.
After 27 years in South African jails, Nelson Mandela is a free man. At 2:15 today, our time, he walked from the gates of Victor Verster prison, hand in hand with his wife, Winnie.
Not just a day of celebration for South Africans, but for the world.
I greet you all in the name of peace, democracy, and freedom for all.
The man called South Africa's Washington and Lincoln rolled into one. The National Liberator was liberated 20 years ago today. We celebrate Nelson Mandela on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee. From Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning. It's Thursday, February 11th, and the takeaway is how many times has a government made a hero out of someone by throwing them into jail?
Yes, indeed. And of course, the legacy of Nelson Mandela is huge. They still call him Madiba in South Africa. Speaking of anniversaries, let's get right to the headlines this morning. It's the 31st anniversary of the Islamic Revolution in Iran, and Iran's president marked it with a chilling announcement. Mahmoud Ahmadinejad declared that Iran is now a nuclear state because it's produced its first batch of 20% enriched uranium. His backdrop for that announcement? Sea of government supporters in Tehran, hundreds of thousands strong, approved the announcement. Meanwhile, anti-government protesters were attacked by riot police who fired tear gas to disperse them and paintballs to mark them for arrest. Earlier, we spoke to a citizen of Tehran, Akbar, who didn't want us to use his full name. He told us the government has clamped down on all forms of media.
Absolutely every sound that is made is registered by the government. It's an absolute police state.
Today's rallies come hours after President Obama placed new sanctions on Iran, specifically its Revolutionary Guard.
Here at home, the number of newly laid off workers seeking unemployment benefits fell sharply last week, a hopeful sign the job market may be improving. The Labor Department says first-time claims for unemployment insurance dropped by 43,000 to a seasonally adjusted 440,000. It's going to be a while, though, until all the jobs lost in the Great Recession come back. We're joined now by Donald Jones. He's unemployed for the first time at age 60. Used to sell photographic equipment before he was laid off. Donald, how long have you been unemployed?
It's going on about a year and a half now.
Have you found that the long-term unemployment has affected you in some surprising ways?
You know, I think your job is such a huge part of your identity, and you're used to being a provider for your family, and you sort of feel an isolation, even though in Detroit you're not exactly isolated when you're unemployed, but you still feel as though you're kind of on the outside looking in.
We're going to explore that more with you, Donald Jones. Stay with us. In Haiti, Reuters is reporting the American missionaries charged with kidnapping children will be released and freed as early as today. No confirmation on that, but the judge in the case is expected to rule on whether to proceed with the trial.
And as they're shoveling snow all over the East and Midwest, let's take a look at the markets. Asian markets are up. European indices are mixed. Futures are up. The Dow gets underway in about a half hour at 10,038. The S&P opens at 1,068, and the NASDAQ opens at 2147. Coming up... We'll talk with some participants in tonight's broadcast of the White House series of civil rights music. Members of the Howard University Choir join us later this hour.
We're also talking about the psychiatric community. They're gathering today to talk about new labels for illnesses. Sometimes having a name for an illness can be a big step for patients in getting help. What's the power of a label? Chana is 17 years old, post to our site. The label of diabetes accentuates the negatives of being labeled. When my high school class took a trip to New York, I was stuck with a school nurse as a chaperone who forced me to eat far more than I knew was good for me. Give us your stories at 8778-MY-TAKE or post it on the site, thetakeaway.org.
We'll be right back. Our most urgent task is job creation.
This is a very tough economy.
20,000 jobs were lost last month.
And it's probably going to rise further before it starts to come down again.
So when I feel 10, 8, I don't know. I just know I'm unemployed.
Jobs. We need jobs. I don't have kids. My husband and I don't own a home. We need jobs.
It takes some time for jobs to get created again.
Positive news out this morning. The number of newly laid off workers seeking unemployment benefits fell sharply last week as the number of those collecting unemployment for more than a week fell to its lowest level in more than a year. But still, the numbers in terms of long-term unemployment are stark. There are 6 unemployed people in the United States for every job that's available. That's a record high. And another record high is the time that people remain unemployed. It's now at 31 weeks, the highest it's been since we started keeping those records. We're joined now by Donald Jones. He's a 60-year-old who's been unemployed for a year and a half. Donald, the thing that fascinates me about your story is you grew up with a grandfather who lost his job during the Great Depression, and he would tell you stories about how you should never take things for granted.
Exactly. We were sort of brought up in a security type of thing where we didn't have to worry about it. You know, there was things taken for granted, I think, and he used to tell me stories. Actually, the grandfather on the one side of the family was brought up through the General Motors Corporation, so they put him through law school, and I think he got through it relatively unscathed. But on my mother's side, he was the beneficiary of the WPA program, so that he found work when the government came through with some money to repair the roads and whatnot.
Did you ever think that at age 60 you would be back in the same place that your grandfather was?
No, I never thought in a million years that I would. Like I said, we were sort of coming up thinking that things were secure, and we felt, that there was going to be work in what we did. If you did a good job and stuff and that, you would have some form of security.
Let's talk now to Hashim Yeomans-Benford. He's a community organizer with the Miami Workers Center. It's a nonprofit that promotes racial and economic justice. Hashim, you work with minority communities in Miami. Have you seen the same people coming in month after month after month looking for services?
Yeah, I think the number has definitely increased. And, what we've seen in our community is a problem go from bad to worse. Because really in working communities and in communities of color, we've been in a recession for the last 30 years in reality. And so the recent spike in unemployment and the recent housing crisis have really turned that recession into a depression.
Well, how have you seen people's maybe demeanor or their attitudes change as the months go on and they remain unemployed? Do they begin to lose some sense of hope, or as Donald was talking about earlier, do they begin to lose some of their identity?
Yeah, I think definitely unemployment. When you talk about unemployment, we have to realize that it has a very destabilizing effect in people's lives. And so we see it affect people at the individual level. We have a family that is a part of our organization. The mother and the father worked and paid bills for many years, but the types of jobs that are often available in our communities offer little job security and no benefits. So in 2008, they lost their jobs. They were forced to move in with some relatives. That home ultimately went into foreclosure. And what happens is that kind of kicks off a cycle that's very hard to get out of, because it's very hard to have a job when you don't have a stable home. It's hard to find work. Then it has psychological impacts on the children. And so in communities where unemployment is very high, this destabilizing effect in individual homes turns into the destabilization of the community as a whole, which has pretty big political impacts as people are forced to move, so it changes the dynamics of electorates. And as more and more communities become destabilized, we start having a national crisis, and it actually becomes a national security question.
So, Donald Jones, we have a recording of a song. This is a song that you wrote back in 1980, which was another economic downturn, but it suddenly had new meaning for you after you lost your job.
Bank man, tax man, got me on the run. Money's all gone, so is all my fun. Can't find a job, nowhere to be free. Better not mess with my dignity.
Better not mess with my dignity. Donald, this can be a sensitive subject, but for people who experience long-term unemployment, there are psychological issues that are associated with that. Losing your dignity, you talked about losing your sense of identity, and there's also senses of isolation and depression that come along when you go week after week, month after month, without a job.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. You start to look at your self-worth, and it really does take a beating. You go places like the grocery store or whatever, and there's people working, and it might be a place that you applied for where you haven't been able to get a job there, and you think, well, you know, I'm out here and there and there. It does start to take a hit on you. I think it really helps, like the gentleman said that you were just talking to get politically active. We have things in Detroit here where we fight against the foreclosure. We have the People's Summit and places like that. And I think it helps to get out and try to make a difference in it. It does make a difference if you get involved, and it gets rid of some of the anger, too.
That's Donald Jones. Hashim, you're hearing Donald Jones from Detroit, a 60-year-old, and he's been unemployed for a year and a half. You, in your work with the community organization in Miami, must see people like that all the time. Do you have people that come in needing reassurance? Are they questioning their own self-worth?
I think more than anything, what happens is people become disillusioned with a lot of the stories we're told about what this country is supposed to be and what opportunity is supposed to look like. And, you know, the role of an organization like ours, and, you know, there's many of us across the country that do this work, is to try to organize those people and put pressure on the state to provide the type of solutions that are actually going to address the deeper systemic issues behind this unemployment. So to try to take, those psychological questionings and the anger and try to focus that to get politically active, like Don said, and actually get some real solutions implemented.
Hashim Yeomans Benford is a community organizer with the Miami Workers Center. It's a local nonprofit in Miami that promotes racial and economic justice. Donald Jones is unemployed for the first time at age 60. He used to sell photographic equipment until he got laid off. He joined us from Detroit. He's also one of our listeners who originally called us with his story back in November. And we're always anxious to hear your stories. You can call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or give us your story at thetakeaway.org. And it's 15 minutes past the hour. Let's check in now on the headlines.
Those back-to-back blizzards in the Mid-Atlantic region have more than tens of thousands of people remaining in the dark. 100,000 utility customers in Pennsylvania were left without power. Some never got it back after the last storm, and the lights are still out for thousands in Delaware. Foreclosures for last month are down 10% in the U.S. compared to December. 315,000 homeowners were sent foreclosure notices in January. The improved month-to-month figure is still 15% higher than the same time last year. Reuters is reporting the American missionaries in Haiti charged with kidnapping will be released and freed as early as today. There's no official confirmation on that, but the judge in the case is expected to rule on whether to proceed with a trial.
In Iraq, hundreds of private security guards have been told to leave the country by the end of this week. The guards are linked to the security company Blackwater Worldwide. The order comes after a U.S. judge dismissed criminal charges against five Blackwater guards accused of shooting 17 people in Baghdad in 2007. And there's a party atmosphere in South Africa today. That's the sound of singing in Cape Town as South Africans mark the 20th anniversary of Nelson Mandela's release from prison. Former President Mandela, who's 91 years old, is expected to make an appearance later in the day. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning. Coming up, it's nearly a month since Haiti was hit by a devastating earthquake, and the UN chief responsible for coordinating all the relief efforts from around the world finally tracked him down. He had a moment to speak with us, and we'll talk with him in a moment.
We're also going to talk about Mandela 20 years after his freedom later on in the program.
Hey, you want that to go?
Our first news takeout comes from Haiti, and we welcome an individual who we've been trying to reach for quite some time since the Haitian earthquake, but who for very obvious reasons has been pretty darn busy down there in Port-au-Prince. Shane Gilbert joins us, chief of the Joint Operations and Tasking Center for the United Nations in Haiti. Good morning, Shane.
Good morning, John.
So, the UN was one of the big victims right after the earthquake. I mean, you arrived in the country, and not only was the nation devastated, but UN operations were devastated. How did you begin to pick up the pieces when you arrived? 5 days after the earthquake?
Well, a fairly traumatic experience. As you mentioned, we lost about over 40 of our staff, including our senior leadership. So the first thing we had to do was we brought down some senior people from UN headquarters in New York, and we just started picking up the pieces. So it was very almost like a combat zone down here.
We're familiar with the face of the United Nations as a kind of a thoughtful, diplomatic, maybe sometimes a slightly wordy character on the world stage. You are the other face of the UN that actually gets things done, that mobilizes the kind of action end of the United Nations. What kinds of things did you have to do, and how different are you from those sober, sometimes boring speeches in the Security Council?
Yes, I've worked at both ends of the spectrum. Of course, in this situation, we're dealing with a number of member states and the host country itself, and we all share the same purpose, and that makes it a lot easier for us to act. Because we do share the same purpose, everyone was willing to work out how best we could work together. So in our role here in the JOTC, for example, all we did is we provided the opportunity for all of those member states and organizations to come together to be able to share the information that we could possibly gather, and then work with the humanitarian community to try and meet their needs that they couldn't deliver themselves. So that worked fairly well. The only difficult part, I guess, was just ensuring that we all knew how we would talk to each other and what procedures we would follow so that we wouldn't step on each other's toes. So that took a little while to do, but we got there.
Shane told us this morning that it started raining in Haiti today, and the challenge of getting new shelter to the refugees is what his top job is right now. Shane Gilbert, Chief of Joint Operations in the Tasking Center for the United Nations in Haiti.
And now for an update on Asian carp. The federal government has crafted an almost $80 million battle plan to fight off Asian carp in the Great Lakes. Joining us is Nathan Hurst. He's the Washington correspondent for the Detroit News. Nathan, what is this $80 million supposed to pay for?
It's going toward a number of carp fighting efforts, including a limited closure of the locks in Chicago that connect the Lake Michigan basin to Mississippi River, and also some controlled poisoning efforts and an installation of new barriers to keep the fish out of Lake Michigan.
Well, the Governor Granholm of Michigan has said that $80 million is not nearly enough to deal with the problem.
Well, and she's got some good statistics to back it up. The state surrounding the Great Lakes spend well over $100 million a year battling lamprey eels and also zebra mussels, which are other very harmful invasive species on the Great Lakes. It's quite an expensive effort once an actual invasion has occurred.
You know, people who may not know much about this story would wonder what the big fuss is about whether or not these fish get into the Great Lakes, but scientists tell us that this is a crisis in the making should these fish pass by Chicago and head into the Great Lakes.
They're best described as very, very hungry fish, and they sift plankton out of the water and are basically able to sift out all of the food that any other aquatic life would eat before they're able to get to it. So they very quickly take over an ecosystem, and it is considered at a very red alert crisis level kind of deal.
And there's also a lawsuit pending filed by the Michigan State Attorney General, but also there's four other states that are in that lawsuit. What's the status on the suit against the government?
Right now, nothing has happened with it. It was rejected by the court, and then it was refiled. So we're still waiting to hear back on that. But they will be pushing forward pretty heavy on that lawsuit.
Okay, Nathan Hurst is the Washington correspondent for the Detroit News.
Our last takeout consists of some snow day memories from you.
It was 1947. I lived in New York City at the time, and up until that time, we had never had a snowstorm like that before.
That's Annette in Montclair, New Jersey, talking about a snowstorm memory that we asked you to deliver to us at 8778-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. Annette went on.
And with dozens and dozens of kids, we threw snowballs at each other. We rolled in the snow. We were so upbeat. We were so happy. In those days, schools did not close on snow days because everyone was able to walk to their local school. It was a glorious time.
More memories from Patty. She posts on our website, thetakeaway.org. She says, growing up in Western Washington State, I remember the smell of oatmeal being made and the radio on with the farm report playing. And then the announcement would come that schools were closed. My three brothers and I would cheer and carry on until my mom told us to go outside. We'd sled, build massive snow forts complete with candles for warmth and light. We'd stay out until our skin started to itch from the cold.
Oh, I can feel that.
Then it was inside for hours and hours of ping pong, the best when we knew we'd be out for days, and then you could relax and enjoy it.
Elle here had a good one. She sent it to our website. To get a snow day, the wind chill had to be 30 degrees below zero, the kind of cold that burns the inside of your nose the second you step outside. When that happened, my friends and I were overjoyed to the point that our judgment was impaired. We'd all end up at the ski hill together, bundled beyond recognition. We'd take one run, then rush into the chalet for shelter and hot cocoa. After an hour or so, when we could finally feel our toes again, we'd take another run, then rush back into the chalet. It takes a little insanity and a lot of love for winter to take advantage of a snow day in the, guess where she's from?
The UP.
The UP, the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. I think those days grew our Youper pride.
Youpers from the UP.
Yeah, for
Youpers. I feel kind of jealous of all these snow memories having grown up near the beach in Southern California. If you have a particularly fond snowy day memory, let us know at 8778-MYTAKE, or you can go to our website, thetakeaway.org.
Thanks for sharing.
Coming up, we're going to go back 20 years.
Now Mr. Mandela walks through the gate. He's a free man. I hope this moment.
We remember the 20-year anniversary of Nelson Mandela's release, and look at how the country is celebrating today. The world is celebrating today, actually.
That voice just, you know that voice.
Nelson Mandela's voice? Absolutely. Yeah, you recognize it immediately.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
So, coming up, it's the 20th anniversary of Nelson Mandela's release. We look back at that moment, hear some great voices, and look at today's celebrations, too, in just a few moments. Right now, let's check in on the top news stories at 30 minutes after the hour. You're listening to hundreds of thousands of government supporters in Tehran this morning cheering and marching through the streets to mark the 31st anniversary of the Islamic Revolution. The man at the podium speaking to those demonstrators is President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. He told the crowds that Iran is now a nuclear state because it's produced its first batch of 20% enriched uranium, but it's far below weapons grade. In Afghanistan, U.S. Marines and Taliban fighters exchanged gunfires on the outskirts of Marja, coming at the site of a major attack in the coming days.
New economic numbers out this morning. The number of newly laid off workers seeking unemployment benefits fell sharply last week, a hopeful sign for the job market. The Labor Department says first-time claims for unemployment insurance dropped to 440,000. That's the lowest total in a month. And new foreclosure numbers for January are also out.
We saw a marginal decrease in foreclosure activity in January. It was down about 10% from December. But unfortunately, it was up 15% year over year.
That's Realty Tracks Rick Sharga saying the foreclosure rate probably won't get better until next year. And the leaders of the European Union have offered Greece support this morning with its debt crisis. There's nothing concrete we know of, no firm offer of financial aid. Greece is in danger of defaulting on its $420 billion debt. Looking at the markets, they're now open. The Dow is down by about 3, the S&P down about 1, and the Nasdaq down also about 3. Those are some of the stories that we're watching this morning.
Hard to believe it's been 20 years, but 20 years after the dissident leader of the African National Congress, Nelson Mandela, walked free from a South African prison and became one of the most powerful political reformers in modern history. It's worth noting that two of the most acclaimed films released this year are a retelling of the iconic fable of Mandela's rise and the fall of apartheid. This is from the soundtrack of the movie District 9. It's up for a Best Picture Oscar, and it's the retelling of the liberation of the black township Soweto through a story about space aliens, quite literally. And the other film is Invictus, which is a retelling of the victory of the Springbok rugby team after the fall of apartheid, which, along with Nelson Mandela, brought the nation of South Africa together. Here's Morgan Freeman as Nelson Mandela.
You elected me your leader. Let me lead you now.
Mandela resonates throughout global culture, and 20 years ago today, he was released from prison after 27 years behind bars. Here's his voice speaking in 1990.
You've achieved legendary status during your years in prison, Mr. Mandela. Are you worried about living up to that legendary status?
No.
there is no single individual who can undertake the enormous task of solving the problems of this country.
Breathtaking. The sound of that voice so familiar. The man who conducted that interview with Nelson Mandela joins us now, James Robbins. He's now BBC diplomatic correspondent. He joins us from London. Good morning, James.
Good morning.
Also with us is Fatima Mir, a friend and biographer of Nelson Mandela. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
So, Fatima, why do you think Nelson Mandela resonates as such an iconic figure throughout world culture even today?
It's because he's almost like the blessed figure we had in Mahatma Gandhi. He is one of those rare individuals who, when he came out of prison, it is remarkable that he never in any way...
Well, it certainly is remarkable. Mm-hmm. Fatima Mir is a biographer of Nelson Mandela, the author of Higher Than Hope, and she joins us from Durban, South Africa. What kinds of commemorations are going on around the world, James Robbins?
Well, I think the chief commemoration today is the fact that many ANC leaders, those involved in the release of Nelson Mandela 20 years ago, have gone back to the gates of Victor Verster Prison in the Cape, in the beautiful winelands of the Cape, although it can't have seemed very beautiful to Nelson Mandela coming towards the end of his 27 years in prison. And he will be the guest of honour later on today when his successor, President Jacob Zuma, makes his State of the Nation speech at the end of the day. I mean, I endorse and agree with everything that Fatima Mir was telling us. He is such a remarkable figure because he has absolutely transcended the suffering that he went through, that others went through with him in prison. He came out, of course, committed not just to continuing the struggle for a non-racial South Africa, because let's remind ourselves, 20 years ago, it was certainly not that, and there were long and difficult years of negotiation ahead with the president who released him, President F.W. de Klerk. But Nelson Mandela also came out preaching very strongly the message of forgiveness, which has taken deep root in modern South Africa.
You know, James Robbins, I'm wondering, throughout this last 20 years, Nelson Mandela has maintained his stature, but he's always been a skeptic of his own legacy and his impact on human rights in the world. Those seem to be contradictory, yet his stature has increased throughout these 20 years.
Well, I think he is quintessentially a modest man. I mean, in that little clip of a fragment of the interview that I had with him, I was privileged to have with him within a couple of days of his release back in 1990. I was pretty stunned when I asked him if he would find it hard to live up to his legendary status, and he said the single word no. I was a bit taken aback, but of course he went on to say that it wasn't him who everybody should judge and look to, but his organisation, the African National Congress. And he's always deferred to the idea of the collective will, the collective determination of the people of South Africa to be free. But there's no doubt, frankly, that without his leadership, it would have been very much more difficult to achieve that.
Fatima Mir, a biographer of Nelson Mandela, what do you think the leader in this speech that he's going to give, a State of the Nation speech that he's expected to give today, would say about the next 20 years in South Africa and in his mission for the world?
Well, we are all hoping and helping Rhodesia to recover herself. And I think that Nelson Mandela will still play a very important role there.
And, you know, he is 91. He does seem like he would live forever. Fatima Mir is a friend and biographer of Nelson Mandela. She's the author of Higher Than Hope, a biography of the man who walked out of prison 20 years ago today. James Robbins, a final thought, BBC diplomatic correspondent.
Well, just Nelson Mandela still plays an extraordinarily powerful unifying role in South Africa. And a final thought, I spent some time at the University of Cape Town with young students, 20-year-olds now, either not quite born or just being born when Nelson Mandela came out of prison. And I did that deliberately because for them this is already an event in history, important though it is. And the powerful message that came across from them was one both of great optimism, and we're talking now of course about black, white, Indian students, mixed race students on a campus which was predominantly white before Nelson Mandela was released, huge optimism, coupled with, from one of them at least, a doubt about whether the unity of purpose that has guided South Africa through the last Indeed. 20 years will outlive Nelson Mandela, because they recognize his importance.
Well, 20 years ago, he walked free. James Robbins, BBC diplomatic correspondent in South Africa, remembering Nelson Mandela. And we'll take you to voices of that day 20 years ago when Nelson Mandela walked free.
And now Mr. Mandela walks through the gate. He's a free man out of this moment. He's waving his fist repeatedly in the air. He's smiling. He's a very alert, very imposing-looking figure, slightly graying hair, upright, a beaming Winnie Mandela alongside him. The crowd are responding with their fists raised in the air, too.
Coming up, we talk about tonight's broadcast of the White House series of civil rights music with members of the Howard University Choir later this hour. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Celeste Headlee. Heavy winter storms have swept over the Northeast and blanketed the streets from West Virginia all the way to Massachusetts. Our nation's capital has been shut down all week with what has been the snowiest winter in D.C.'s recorded history. Snowstorms make a lot of us think about shoveling or school cancellations, maybe treacherous driving. But according to our next guest, snow has actually been a big part of our culture in this country, and it's played a big part in our history as well. Bernard Mergen is a professor emeritus of American Studies at George Washington University, author of Snow in America and Weather Matters, an American Cultural History Since 1900. Good morning.
Good morning, Celeste.
So this goes way beyond somebody telling you to restrict your conversation to your health and the weather, right? You're saying that that weather has actually mattered in terms of shaping our American personality.
I believe so. I mean, I wouldn't ever claim that Americans are unique in their perceptions of weather, but every part of the country really has different perceptions based on their expectations. And that's probably the number one way in which weather affects history, is that it creates expectations about the normal, and then it challenges those expectations every once in a while.
Because it's always abnormal. Give me an example of what you're talking about.
Well, I guess... there are any number of, I mean, most recently, of course, is Katrina, because of the expectations of hurricanes along the coast, but when they exceed the expectations, the result is catastrophe and the soul-searching that comes afterward. And so we seem to go through cycles of these. I'm interested in my books in the way, maybe not the big sort of way in which the wind sank the Armada or the iceberg sank the Titanic or something, in the way that weather changes history, but in the way that weather constantly nudges us in certain directions. That is, I'm thinking there was a long time in which the Weather Bureau refused to acknowledge the term tornado. The weather forecasters from 1880s through the 1930s were not supposed to mention tornadoes in their forecasts because there was a fear that they would panic people and the predictions weren't very good. But the great tornadoes in 1925, the so-called tri-state tornado in Missouri, Indiana, and Illinois, which killed between 600 and 900 people, really forced the Weather Bureau to rethink its approach. And again, in 1933, the Navy dirigible, the Akron, crashed in a storm off Atlantic City. And a lot of people blamed the Weather Bureau for being too slow to adopt new methods of forecasting. And so President Roosevelt appointed a very high-level commission, including the Nobel Prize-winning physicist Millikan, and they completely revamped the Weather Bureau in the 30s. So I'm looking at these things that maybe don't make the headlines but affect the way in which we are dealing with the weather today, because the Weather Bureau has changed to keep up with the times.
And certainly in each region of the country, they have a different view of holidays, whether it be July 4th or Christmas or something else, depending on what the weather looks like out their window. That's Bernard Mergen, Professor Emeritus of American Studies at George Washington University.
He's kind of the Howard Zinn of snow, I think. Historian,
the
social
people's
historian.
History of snow? Yeah.
Yes, I think so.
Snow
think
in
so.
America is his book. He also wrote Weather Matters, an American Cultural History Since 1900. Thanks so much, Professor Mergen.
Some corn for poppin'. The lights are turned way down low. Let it snow, let it snow.
Good morning. I'm Celeste Headley here with John Hockenberry. Coming up, we talk about the concert at the White House, in which the halls were ringing with the music from the Civil Rights Movement. And we'll speak with two people who sang in the White House from the Howard University Choir.
Are you going to sing? Are you going to sing?
I am not going to sing. No, it's their moment to shine. First, here's a check on leading stories at 47 minutes after the hour. The latest jobless figures came out this morning. First-time jobless claims dropped by more than expected to 440,000 last week. The White House has some more positive news on the jobs front. A report from the Council of Economic Advisers says an average of 100,000 more jobs will be created each month this year across the country. The Republican take on the jobs report is more critical. Republican House Whip Eric Cantor says the Obama administration's report is full of, quote, praise for its own failed policies of the past year.
Citigroup has announced a pilot program which will allow homeowners who are about to face foreclosure to stay in their property. They will be allowed to stay in their homes for an extra 6 months rather than face immediate eviction. Tributes are coming in this morning for the former Texas Democratic Congressman Charlie Wilson, who died yesterday. Here he is in 1996 announcing that he was stepping down from Congress.
There is a time for everything, and my internal clock tells me that 36 years in public office is enough.
Speaking about the former congressman, Defense Secretary Robert Gates said he helped, quote, bring the Cold War to a close. Wilson worked to funnel millions of dollars in weapons to Afghan rebels who fought off the Soviet Union. It was an act of bipartisanship that we can scarcely imagine today. Wilson was 76. And those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
That song, Lord, I Done Done What You Told Me To Do, resounded through the halls of the White House on Tuesday night. That's the voices of the Howard University Choir. They were part of a White House performance series that's called A Celebration of Music from the Civil Rights Movement. The event included artists like Jennifer Hudson, Bob Dylan, John Legend, and many others. It'll be broadcast on most PBS stations tonight at 8 p.m. And we have two members of the Howard University Choir with us this morning. Good morning to Dr. James Weldon Norris. He's the conductor and director of the choir and a music professor at Howard. And his grandson, Brandon D. Strong, a singer and manager of the choir. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Dr. Norris, you have a long career, but you actually arranged that song that we were just hearing from the Howard University Choir, which was performed at the White House. How did you write the song, Lord, I Done Done?
Well, you must remember I was raised in South Carolina, and my grandfather was a Baptist minister. So traveling with him throughout my youth, I heard these old church songs sung frequently. So this is an old black church tune that's absolutely just fascinates me every time I would hear it. It would usually be sung often after communion or sometimes at funerals and things like that. And so we were performing one night in Connecticut during the Beethoven Ninth. And on the way back, the bus was quiet. So I took out my music paper and my pen and I started to jot this tune down and do the arrangement. And I'm so glad I did because I just love it very much.
You know, the Howard University Choir, I'm sure they sing a number of spirituals, and the singing of spirituals with university choirs, it doesn't have as long of a history, perhaps, as many people think. Here's a recording of the Fisk Jubilee Singers from 1955. Fisk Singers were actually the first choir, really, to bring spirituals into the concert hall. And at the time, it was kind of revolutionary. The singing of spirituals was not entirely accepted by the African-American community.
Well, at this particular time, I don't think that you could say it wasn't accepted by the African-American community, but at the time the original Fisk Jubilee Singers did that, it's that most people just didn't get a chance to hear them. The Fisk Jubilee Singers, I happen to have been the beginning, let's say, of the Negro spiritual as a concert art form. And they really made it into one and developed one. It's absolutely fantastic the way they did it. In the later years, I think it became somewhat unpopular, let's say, to sing spirituals on college campuses and things because we were just going into a new light and it was very unfortunate.
You kind of wanted to, people felt like you wanted to move on, is that what you mean?
So what now?
The people felt like they should move on from the Negro spiritual tradition?
Yes, they didn't want to sing these old songs, reminded them of old times, they said, you know, one of those things. And it was very unfortunate. But then it began to revive. And with many of the traditional black colleges in America, you know, which were the church-owned, the spiritual began to be popular again, and people began to sing them and have a new respect for them and a new light for them.
Well, let's ask a younger generation, your grandson, Brandon D. Strong, a singer with the Howard University Choir. Brandon, how do you feel about the singing of these, what your grandfather just called, old songs?
Well, for my generation, we can't really relate to the music. However, it does mean something to us. And especially the other night, singing in the White House, you got a sense of the African diaspora, what it means to be the descendants of African Americans, and like a conceptual view of your culture.
But you don't feel a connection when you sing the words. That doesn't make you call up any special connection between you and the songs.
No, ma'am. Honestly, because these songs, most of the time, were used as coping mechanisms, like he said, in funerals. Then you have chain gang songs, and they were songs that represented what was going on at the time. And in my generation, we haven't had to go through struggles in the same right that they have. And our music that speaks through us now is so much different.
Who was you were there, Brandon, singing with a lot of famous performers. Who was the person you're most excited to sing near?
Honestly, Bob Dylan. Being on the same program as Bob Dylan struck a chord with me.
And you left right before Natalie Cole and Jennifer Hudson took the stage, is that right?
We left after Jennifer Hudson and Smokey Robinson sang, but before the Blind Boys of Alabama performed.
Oh, they're great.
Dr. James,
to because of the snow.
Oh yeah, you had to travel out of D.C. before you got right. stuck there and couldn't get back to Howard University. You know, Dr. James Weldon Norris, it's very difficult for me to not associate your name with the famous civil rights singer James Weldon Johnson. You wouldn't happen to have been named after him, were you?
I was. James Weldon Johnson and my father were fraternity brothers, and so my mother tells me, and he insisted I be named after him.
I was just going to say, Johnson was a teacher at Fisk.
He was a teacher at Fisk, yes. He was a teacher at Fisk, a great writer. And he and his brother, J. Roseman Johnson, were great musicians. And they collaborated quite a bit. So you can see that his writing, Lift Up Your Voice and Sing, and our performing it, often it means so very, very much to me. Because if you actually dissect that poetry with the surgical scalpel, I call it, you will find that every line is a sermon.
Oh, that's interesting.
And it's a magnificent piece of music.
And Lift Every Voice and Sing, often called the African American National Anthem, written by James Weldon Johnson. Thanks to both of you for joining us. James Weldon Norris, director and conductor of Howard University Choir, also a professor of music history there, and his grandson, Brandon D. Strong, singer and manager of the choir. That's one of the songs the choir performed at the White House on Wednesday, arranged by James Weldon Norris. You can hear the whole thing, Lord, I Done Done What You Told Me To Do, as performed by the Howard University Choir. It's on our website, thetakeaway.org.
Ooh, leave it there. Leave it there. Nice. All right. Now, if you go to the website, we also have a project for you that needs your photos.
God loves a terrier.
Remember, yes, Best in Show? The Westminster Dog Show is coming up next week, and we're having our own dog show. Send us a photo of your four-legged friend, dog, and we'll judge the Best in Show with our listeners. Post your photos on our Facebook page, and we'll talk about them next week. And instructions on how to do that at thetakeaway.org. It's you and your dog.
My beagle's going to win.
Takeaway. You have a beagle?
I have a beagle.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, I'd love to see the picture. We'd love to hear from you on anything in your lives.
My name is Hector, and I'm phoning from New York. I was unemployed for a year. That period was awful for me.
We talked earlier about how long-term unemployment can have disastrous, stressful consequences, and we've been getting stories like Hector's.
And the most crucial aspect of it was it also led to a separation with my spouse, who suffered a tremendous amount because of decisions I was making or not making. My sense of self was down to an all-time low. In fact, I never even knew that I could feel that way about myself. And it led to my separation, and that was awful. And I do apologize to her because she is a great person, and she suffered a lot. But some people can only put up with so much.
And you know how to reach us, 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. We want to hear it all. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Celeste Headley. This is The Takeaway.
Thanks for listening to The Takeaway podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.